All right, let me hit that. Hit the toggle, yes, then. All right, buenas and half a day, todo santo.
Oh, nanga, nanga.
Nanga? What? Malert? Nah, nanga. Nah. Malert, Zoom? It says meeting is
live
on Facebook.
Okay, we're good.
So, good or how?
Wungan.
I'm sure, hold on. Did I get a notification?
Yeah, it's there now. I see it.
Again, I'm going to take your word for it then. Buenas todos, Hanzo. Another episode of Finatsu coming at you via Zoom. Nanusi Michael Luhan Bavakwa, I am your host during this time of lockdown, but that's just because we're in lockdown, it doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. And in fact, here at Independent Wuhan and with Finatsu, We've been enjoying sort of taking advantage of new technology to try to keep the conversation going about political status, about decolonization, about independence, and so on. And so in that spirit, we have a very special, very timely episode today. But before we get into that, though, I want to remind everybody that you can support Finatsu by signing up as a patron through Patreon. And so, Sidus Masi to the more than 20 individuals who currently support Finatsu. They agree to donate at least $1, some as many as $15 a month to sort of support independent and indigenous media, the podcasts that we put out there, the sort of the conversations that we keep going. And so, if you are able, even though times are difficult right now, please consider signing up as a patron. Just $1 a month helps a little bit. And for those of you that are currently patrons, if you're having financial difficulties, please send us an email. Please get in touch with us. We hope that because we totally understand and we want to check in with you and see how you're doing. But if you do sign up as a patron, you get access to the special extras, the perks that we offer at Finatsu. These are special podcasts, which only those who donate to support the work of Finatsu that they get to access, such as the Secret Guam History Podcast, the Radical Reading Series, and stuff like that. And so if you are able, engin sinyahaw, engin gaigwanahaw, putpabot, considera esti na na in supportiham GST ibunito dan yapaguna metatumam. And so we have some wonderful guests with us here today. What we are talking about in this time of the coronavirus, in this time of crisis, when we are all locked down, I'm on this island and we're worrying about sort of the future, the safety of our families and so on, what happens next. In English, they often say that there's an elephant in the room, but on Guam, I guess you could say there's an aircraft carrier in the room. There's a giant sort of weaponized caravel in the room. There's an aircraft carrier on the island. And so while we, as a territory of the United States, as we face this crisis, one thing that we have to contend with that's different than our Emmanuel Luther and I, our brothers and sisters across the Pacific, is that we continue to be a territory. We don't have sovereignty, and we also have a huge amount of military bases. One third of the island of Guam is U.S. military facilities. And so as we sort of struggle with this coronavirus, COVID-19 sort of pandemic, our place in that is a little bit different. Are we inhibited in certain ways because we are a territory? We also get some types of support as a territory. But having this huge military presence, how does that impact us? How does that affect us? How does it present different dangers that we may sort of have to contend with? And so in that sort of spirit, we have three guests with us here today. First off, we have Victoria Leon Guerrero, who is the co-chair for Independent Wuhan. And so she comes from us from a beautiful pastoral scene. Lovely. The rest of us are all indoors. Indoors, but Victoria has a nice sort of a lovely backyard there. And so she is representing Independent Wuhan. And then we have from the new group, Ihagan Kamalawan Wuhan, we have Rosario Perez, and we have Heather Garrido. And so, Zawana Besanganiam Zusidus Masi Parifanatam Mizu, who Gofagradesi. And so, let's get started here. One of the issues that we are looking at here is that the USS Theodore Roosevelt, one of the big flagships for the United States, 5,000 sailors on board, that it had the coronavirus on it. The captain sort of spoke out wanting a place where he could offload his sailors. And one of the and the place where they ended up putting it is here in Guam. Now, Ihagan Pamalawan Guahan, as well as other groups such as Independent Guahan, the Guahan Coalition for Peace and Justice, they all wrote a letter talking to the Magahaga, imploring her to recognize these other realities, these other risks that sort of taking these sailors in that they might represent. And so let me ask you first off, so what compelled you to write this letter, sort of to speak out in this time? Because oftentimes when there is a panic, large-scale public concern, people feel that they shouldn't speak up, that it's not okay to sort of question or challenge things. So what compelled you in this moment to sort of write this letter to speak out on this issue?
So I think at the time, there were so many emotions going on. You know, we're getting so much information, whether that be true or false information through social media. And we as Ihagan Pamalawan Guahan felt that, you know, we needed to respond. You know, there's so much fear, there's so much anger, uncertainty. And we felt as a group, our responsibility to respond. You know, we wanted to inform our Magahaga of our concerns, and we wanted to encourage her to take action. You know, we see her, she is this symbol for us. She is our, this connection to the military, this the closest one. And so we wanted her to be a part of the decisions being made for our island.
And to kind of just follow what Heather was saying, truth be told, it's been incredibly difficult to keep up with all the different news that's going on out there. I know before this podcast, Heather and I had got together to kind of brainstorm, like, hey, let's kind of make sure we're on the same page and let's share our thoughts and ideas to soundboard with each other. And one of the things that I know we mutually felt was that it's very difficult to keep up with everything that's happening. I myself, I'm in a master's program and I'm hoping to finish by this May. So a lot of things are happening all at once here in my program and, of course, at home, at just like everybody else on the rest of Guam. And the biggest, I guess, catalyst, I think, to this letter was the fact that Guam was not consulted in the process of having 5,000 sailors who may or may not be positive for COVID-19. We now know 155 of them are. To be here on Guam, and then of course now housing them in Tumon. I apologize if I'm jumping ahead, but yeah, a lot of it was to one, Magahaga, I think we need to push for Guam to be present at this table of discussion. And not only that, I mean, being a territory, we all know and acknowledge that Guam does not have that right, so to speak. I don't know how else to say that plainly. And when, because we don't have a right, it doesn't mean that our Magahaga should not voice the concern that, hey, we're not okay with this. Like, you can't be doing this, but we're not okay with it. Yeah, that just to kind of add to what Heather was saying.
Victoria?
Yeah, I think another major issue that's pointed out in the letter is, one is, of course, Guahan as an unincorporated territory, as Rosario has pointed out, does not actually have the ability, like other independent islands around us, to really protect the island from continuing to bring in COVID. And so in the early days of our, from when we first got our first case to today, people were saying, shut down the island, shut down the island. Well, the governor and the governor's staff had continually pointed out that we don't have the power to do that. and that the governor is doing everything she can within her power. And so I think as a community, we were shown in many ways reminders of the limitations of our status. And then, you know, I think as women, Ihag and Famalawan really wanted to say to the governor, as women, we are calling on you as a Magathaga, who's really the leader, the person that's supposed to be, at the end of the day, the voice for the people. We want you to be a stronger voice that, in the same way that you were saying that you turned away a cruise ship, which had no confirmed cases of COVID, none of the passengers were sick, and you turned them away in February saying that it was a threat to the island, it was a danger, and that we had to prioritize our island. How then, a month later, does your messaging change and say, Guam is a hospitable island, the military is our partner, we must welcome these sailors? That really struck us as being inconsistent, but also not behaving as a Magathaga should, which was that at the end of the day, looking at our situation, our medical professionals telling us that our healthcare facilities are at capacity, that the island is really going to struggle as the cases continue to come to be able to take care of the basic health needs of our own community, to say, to not just speak out against the military deciding to dock here without informing or consulting the community prior. But then to say, yes, come into the community, stay in the hotels. We trust that you've got this under control. And the reality was that none of us felt like they had it under control, and that we were looking to our Magathaga to be articulate about that, to say that during a time like this, during a pandemic, these antiquated colonial policies that do not allow us to protect our borders, that do not allow us to fully be able to get the supplies we need closer in the region while the U.S. is lagging in trying to get us basic test kits. You know, we those things cannot be happening, that our colonial status is a danger to the health and well-being of our community. And so, you know, when we wrote this letter, that was a lot of the sentiment. Like, let's encourage the Magathaga. Let's remind her that she is the head of state, that she is a leader, and that in Chamorro values and in Chamorro practices, women will take a stronger position when it comes to the health and well-being of their family. And that's what we were hoping from her. And instead, we were, you know, pigeonholed as a small group of critics. The concerns that were really valid that were raised in these letters were exaggerated and taken out of context. So it became, you know, the letter, which was very clear that we didn't want the sailors to continue to spread COVID on the ship and continue to get sick and not be able to get off the ship. What the letter said is stay within the base, right? Contain it within the base. Use the resources you have as the most well-funded military in the world. Use the one-third of our island that you stole and that you occupy and work this out in the base. You're the military. You know how to respond to emergencies. Why does it seem like you don't know how to respond to this one? Why do you seem so unprepared? And why now is it our community's responsibility to take the risk and open the hotels up and to trust that when you go to these hotels, there will be absolutely no interaction with the local community, that there is no potential of this spreading? That's not something our community could do when we were already seeing photos of airmen who were in quarantine in our hotels having a party at the beach and driving back and forth while on quarantine to work. So, you know, it was a lot of uncertainty, as was expressed earlier. And what we were hoping was for stronger leadership locally, because it was clear that that was what was necessary.
And thank you all for you know, for just sort of putting yourself out there in that way, to sort of to express what I think a lot of people were feeling in some way, but maybe didn't feel comfortable sort of speaking out about it. And so one thing that this really brings up is the issue of transparency. So there's always an issue of government transparency, but one thing that we face on Guam for something that for an entity that occupies one third of the island is the issue of military transparency with those of us that live outside the fence. And so Do you feel like the military has been transparent about sort of this issue for COVID-19, about sort of the aircraft carrier, about other issues? Do you feel that in this time of panic, are they, I mean, the thing that we sometimes say almost jokingly is the one Guam approach. The military says one Guam. But then it kind of makes you wonder what kind of one Guam marriage this is, you know, when there's so many secrets, you know, and then what's it called? Your spouse tells you that you can't go shopping at the commissary on these days and stuff like that. But so what are your thoughts on that issue of transparency? Because at a time like this, what we have learned historically from pandemics is that the free flow of accurate information is critical in terms of making plans, in terms of developing strategies to stem the tide. So then what can we say then about the issue of transparency in the military right now? What are your thoughts on that?
So I don't think that they've been transparent enough. At the beginning stage, when they were on their way here, they said they had a very low number of infected soldiers. And then all of a sudden, there's 155. And as we've seen in the, if you have watched the governor's state address, they were talking about the exponential growth of the disease for our own people. What about the exponential growth for those that are on that ship? And so the captain, Crozier, who has been fired, I just read an article on the Stars and Stripes that said the only reason that he was urging for help and why we found out about the amount of the soldiers, the 155, is because his letter was accidentally leaked. So there, by accidentally leaked means that we weren't intended to ever get that information. And so there is just not enough transparency. There's not enough truthfulness in this relationship that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I think a classic example is that, you know, literally the day before sort of the news really came out in national media, our local media were questioning the governor in their daily press conference about how many cases are there on the base and how many, and what, you know, there was already some talk about the Roosevelt and that there could be cases on the Roosevelt. They were asked about it. The governor said she didn't know. And then the media's response was, we've been contacting the admiral and nobody's getting back to us. Then we all wake up the next morning and, you know, on my chat and getting sent links to CNN or to The Hill that say that, you know, the carrier is being docked on Guam, that 8 cases have already been flown in, that 36 have tested positive. And then every media outlet you went to, these numbers changed, right? And then our local media outlets were literally reporting what the national media was reporting. So we weren't learning about it from our head of state, our governor. We weren't learning about it from our local news sources. And then the first article that really comes, that the governor is really quoted about the situation, says that she's guaranteeing the community that the sailors are going to stay on the base and on the ship, that they dock the ship as far away from Guam as possible. Nobody's leaving the base. Then in that same article, the Navy is saying, we'd like to work with the local government to get hotel rooms. And then the next day, the governor's saying, we're going to open up our hotel. So it was like everything, the story just couldn't get straight. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, we're all just supposed to follow along and be on board with this. And if you're not on board with this, then you're not following in the Guam spirit of hospitality. We're not being good partners. And the reality is that a good partnership isn't one that's just one-sided, that, you know, that Guam has always been, I mean, we already give so much in order for the military to be here. We've lost a third of our island, for example, with some of our best resources and land, and our water sources are on these bases, right? We give a lot every day. Our people serve in the military. Our people are on the Roosevelt. And yet, you know, questioning whether or not this is the best decision, pointing out that this is really not safe for the community, that the military has more than enough land and resources on their base, questioning that suddenly became taboo in our community, unpatriotic, unloyal, unchamorral, because we weren't being welcoming enough. And, you know, it's like, it's okay for us as a community. So you haven't given us the right information. You haven't given been consistent with us about the information. So how do you expect us to trust that when they go to these hotels, everything will be in place? Why does it feel like plans are changing so rapidly because you don't really know what you're doing? And that, you know, that was really, and it's continuing to this day, right? We get so much information and then we don't hear anything, right? And then we get new numbers from national media and not necessarily from local media or government officials. And then what ends up happening too is that then it's almost like business as usual, right? Couple days later, nobody's paying attention anymore. And clearly we have a crisis that we're trying to respond to ourselves. And then we lose touch with what's really happening. And who knows, it could be much worse by now. And we don't really know. And there's no obligation for the military to inform us.
Tadouf Mossing, that brings up, so this relationship with the U.S. military and sort of Chamorros, but sort of the civilian population on Guam is such an interesting sort of thing. Because on the one hand, people say it's super patriotic. But on the other hand, there's also always this tension, this feeling that people on Guam, we aren't being respected by the military. Or it's interesting because somebody may post a bunch of memes on Facebook about support the troops, love America or leave it. But then they'll get angry because military guys in Tumon aren't acting respectfully. And so we have this sort of strange existence. And so one thing that was very fascinating to see was just a week before, or a little bit before, sort of the Roosevelt became sort of the big thing. Locally, the discussion was around restriction of locals, National Guardsmen and retirees, and their commissary privileges. And so it was interesting how many people, including people who are normally sort of wouldn't speak out or be critical at all, you had people on social media, people all over the place speaking out that it wasn't fair, it wasn't right, they're being mistreated. And so I wanted to know if any of you wanted to comment on that. Is that something where it can help us understand our relationship to the United States and the fact that sort of at a time when the military is not giving us the information on how the virus is impacting them, they're also sort of trying to limit access of locals to their stores?
If it's okay, I want to revisit the first question. It took me a little bit of time to formulate what I was trying to say, but I will segue into the current question about limiting our retirees into the base. So I don't think the military is transparent, especially with Guam, because, again, we're a territory. I'm going to bring that up several times throughout this podcast today. And I went on the DoD website today because I was like, you know what? I'm going to look for something. And I found, like, when you kind of go through and you look at, okay, about us, you know, the Department of Defense, there was a quote and it said military forces, or rather that the DoD website, I mean, sorry, the DoD is meant to provide military forces needed to deter war and ensure our nation's security. First of all, Guam, I don't think Guam is considered part of this nation in their part of their security. As a matter of fact, Guam is always talked about in the sense of being the tip of the spear. So instead of us, I mean, again, it's hard to argue intent, but instead of us being part of this security that is needed, rather we're the tool to ensure the national security. And it's to me, it's almost not surprising that they're not transparent. It's kind of like if we're just the weapon to them always being prepared to respond to war and ensure the nation's security. I mean, they don't consult their guns before they start using it. So, yeah, I do think for that reason, it illustrates our relationship with the U.S. military as a tool and an instrument, something to be exploited. And I think time and time again, that has been shown. And as far as limiting our local veterans and the National Guardsmen, it was upsetting for me. I mean, I don't personally have any members who, any close members who served in the military, but it was upsetting to hear. It just didn't sit right with me. I mean, they, like the current active members, given so much of their time and their life into serving into the military, and then suddenly they're not able to access the privileges that they get from serving. And so I thought that that was a little, not a little, it was quite upsetting.
And part of what they needed to access,
it's not okay.
I was just going to say they also need to access medication that retirees and active duty or reservists or National Guards members that are all being kept out of the base until the weekend also need to like fill prescriptions, right? And rely on their, even, you know, retirees on a fixed income rely on the lower prices of goods on the base, right? And so now what you're seeing are people standing in long lines outside of these facilities being let in little at a time on the weekend. And likely, you know, who knows what they're getting exposed to while standing in line and all the added stress. And, you know, the reality is that it's a double standard. It's like, okay, you can close the gates to us and say that we're a danger, but not acknowledge that you too are a danger to the community and do everything in your power to respond to the rapid spread of COVID on this ship within your base, you know? So it always kind of, it shows like, I think a lot of the carelessness around containing COVID on that ship and even on the base is very evident. I think, you know, I was really, everybody's really like feeling so bad for Captain Crozier. And, you know, a lot of people have been sharing the big farewell that was given for him on the ship. And the minute I saw it, I was like, Hoffman Acosta, social distancing, SD, because there's no social distance between anybody in that sea of people saying goodbye to him. For somebody who was so deeply concerned about the health and safety of people on the ship, he's not wearing a mask, as you can see in this clip right now. There's clearly not 6 feet between everybody. I mean, I imagine that'd be very impossible on a ship that size. But, you know, still, as he exits, he goes right to the people picking him up and shakes their hand. And those people are now exposed because we've learned that he's positive for COVID. So, you know, understanding the severity of this virus and how easily it spreads, we don't see that in any of these clips of the behavior on the ship in this captain's big farewell. And granted, a farewell is a special circumstance, but I would imagine that as a leader who's so deeply concerned about his sailors, he would have quietly exited. He would have had a mask on, had distance between the people picking him up, but none of that is evident. And so it really didn't match the urgency and the tone of his letter. And so I think that there's this interesting way in which we as a community are very much trying to respond, very much even within our culture, stopping practices like fengyingyi or, you know, showing affection to our loved ones and knowing that even though this hurts us, we are keeping our distance. And then we see here that the military is not keeping their distance and that who knows where the people that picked up Crozier and shook his hand, did they go out into the community because they're not on quarantine? Are they on quarantine? We don't know this. Like, is the base closing off its own personnel that will be, you know, interacting with all the people on the ship? Are they also quarantined? One of the things we were told was that the military would basically staff the hotels, that they would be the ones providing the food and interacting with the sailors that were in quarantine. But that military includes the National Guard, that the National Guard will also be serving these hotels and providing security. Well, I haven't heard whether or not the National Guard members will then also be on quarantine or will they be allowed to go home to their families, right? There's so many things, so many questions I have that are unanswered. And looking at that very small clip, I'm like, wow, like you're closing all our community members who've earned the right to go into the base and, you know, purchase things and cheaper groceries and get their medication. You're closing them out as a danger, but yet you're very clearly not following local mandates to protect the community by keeping your own distance and by not, you know, spreading COVID. I'm terribly confused. And it just frustrates me because I watch all of these like press conferences and I'm waiting for people to ask these kinds of tough questions, you know, and it's just not happening. And I think it's really indicative of our colonial status that questioning becomes something that is wrong, right? If you question, you're unloyal, you're not Chamorro, you're not, you know, patriotic. And we have some tough questions that need answers and we're not getting those answers.
Heather, go on a little.
Yes, so I do come from a family with military veterans who have dedicated 10, 15, 20 years of their life. And personally, I was shocked to see the letter. In my opinion, I felt like it was a wrong decision and more importantly, the wrong approach to the situation. I felt like it was a quick fix to a very panicked situation. But I very much disagree because even though my father, for example, who has dedicated 20 years, is not considered essential at the moment, he doesn't deserve the right to go and utilize the benefits he's worked so hard for. I've also come across a situation where for a dependent, right, say their parent was activated and is a National Guards member who is serving these people, they're not able to go and shop for themselves during this time. And then they're going to have to wait until the weekend and be a part of these long lines that they don't know what they're being exposed to, like Lola was saying. And so I think it was very much a wrong decision because we don't see this happening anywhere else. Anywhere else in the United States is the military limiting base access to civilians or people, National Guardsmen.
What's very interesting because you bring up that point that the military's procedures to sort of protect their stationed sort of personnel, it puts the National Guardsmen, the retirees in that position where they're violating social distancing protocols and stuff. But then it's interesting because we don't hear enough people complaining about that. We do hear a lot of people complaining about the line outside of Bank of Guam. That there's a lot of people saying what is this, Lou Leon Guerrero, not social distancing. And it's like, that double standard is so fascinating to me. It's so intriguing because if we want to be critical, we should be critical, but don't be blind to one thing. And so in what we were just talking about, it's a beautiful moment when the crew says goodbye to their captain, but we shouldn't turn off our ability to be critical or to understand what's going on. And Victoria, as you said, you know, even in a beautiful moment like that, you have to be thinking, should we all be gathering? Shouldn't we be wearing masks? What should we be doing to make sure that we can share this moment, but that it will still survive with us and our, you know, that we stay alive after this and that we don't spread it to other people? But at the same time, people are being very uncritical of the military, and the military is not being particularly transparent. But they're being very critical of people like the MAGA Haga, you know, for even something as simple as that she, at some of her press conferences, she wasn't wearing a mask. Or I think at the one yesterday, her mask was down while she was talking. And so if we're going to be critical of people that are not practicing social distancing, then that's good. But then don't sort of turn off your critique because it's the military. If you're going to critique our local leaders, if you're going to critique us locally, that's great. The military is also here. You should also be critical of them. And so now that we've sort of moved in a direction where my next question, though, it goes, so how can we talk to sort of people locally to help them understand this sort of relationship with the military? Because as many of us have talked about today, there's this feeling that if you say these things, you might be anti-American, you might be anti-military. People will sort of shout you down because they feel like we shouldn't talk about these things. And we used to say that this was only something that the Manumcu war survivors would feel strongly about. But even nowadays, We see many people who just don't want to think critically about these sorts of things. What would you do to sort of talk to people about that, to help them understand our relationship to the military and why it's important that we be critical, that we sort of speak out and that we ask questions? What would you say if you were talking to your cousin, your aunt, your uncle, your friend? How would you speak to them to help them understand?
Well, I think I would clearly point out that, you know, Guam doesn't really have a say in whether or not the Roosevelt could have docked here in the first place, whereas other independent countries, even states, would have been part of the decision about whether or not to even bring the carrier here in this moment, right? And so I think that, like, first of all, it wasn't that Guam was asked and we said no. It showed up. It was already here. And the community was being asked to do something very big that truly the military could have done with or without our governor agreeing to allow them to stay in the hotels. And, you know, that wouldn't be the case anywhere else. And I think that, you know, one of the things we need to remember is that it is okay when people's lives are at stake, when you are already seeing elders dying, when you are seeing as many as 17 positive cases a day in a community as tiny as 160,000 people, to say we really can't do this right now, that enough of our energy needs, all of our energy needs to be spent on ensuring that there are no more deaths. We are a community that, because of colonization, already has health issues related to our colonial diet. The World Health Organization has declared a health crisis in Guam because of the leading rates of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Those are our four leading causes of death. And so these are all already common here. People are already dying very young here. And then to then have, you know, COVID and have it spread so quickly, the likelihood of members of our community dying from COVID is far greater than the likelihood of sailors who are supposed to be in really good health, who are in their 20s, who the Navy keeps assuring us none of them have been hospitalized, to them symptomatic. That's very different from what we're seeing in our community, where children and our elderly, our manamku, are getting very, very sick. And so I think if I were to talk to somebody about it, I would say, look, it's not that, you know, I don't think that the sailors should be helped. It's not that I don't think that they should stop the spread of COVID on the ship. It's that I don't think that Guam is the right place to take this big risk of welcoming them into the community right now. We can't afford that risk because, I mean, gosh, we were literally a few days later given this presentation from the medical community that according to projections, we could see up to 3,000 deaths. That's huge in an island our size. So, you know, I would really put it that way, but I would also frame it as, you know, really taking a look at what the rest of the Pacific is being asked, right? Or how the rest of the Pacific is responding. Earlier, before we went live, I was sharing with everybody, with the guests on Fanatsut, that a wonderful article written by Nick McClellan, a journalist in Australia, for an international site called Inside Story. He looks at the situation with the carrier in Guam. And he points out that not only do territories like Guam not have the ability to turn away basically, you know, 5,000 people that are rapidly spreading COVID, but all U.S. territories are seeing the impacts of not having sovereignty and their ability to fight COVID. So he said, that the Pacific Islands with the highest rates of infection are all under colonial administration, lacking full control of borders, health budgets, and political governance. At time of writing, the independent nation of Fiji had 15 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and Papua New Guinea just 2, despite a population of nearly 10 million. No other cases are reported in independent nations in the region. By contrast, Hawaii had 387 cases with 5 deaths, the U.S. territory of Guam, 112 with 4 deaths. So he kind of goes on to talk about how without, you know, sovereignty, without the ability to control our borders or even turn to other countries closer to us than the U.S., who had obviously taken this virus much more seriously, who had already really been able to flatten their curve, we can't even turn to them and say, hey, could we get test kits from you? Could we get some aid? Could we get some support like Palau is able to do, right, from Taiwan? We don't have that ability. And so as a result, Guam got faulty test kits. We got test kits late. We got far too few. We were only given 200 at first. And then literally, we've just been, you know, kind of working at the pace that the U.S. dictates as its territory. And as we can see, the U.S. responded to this far too late and without the seriousness it deserved. And sadly, the U.S. numbers are so high. And so, you know, I think for us as people, we need to say, why do we need to take our lead from a country that is clearly not even thinking about us, right? Instead, we need to be able to do what we need to do, everything possible that we can do to take care of our people, because we are the only ones that are going to be able to do that, that are going to prioritize that. The Navy was very clear that their priority was their mission and the people on board the ship. They've said that every single time. And granted, after the Roosevelt was docked here and after Guam allowed these guys to stay in the hotel, then the Admiral started showing up to the press conference. And even in that, he said, we will help Guam as your backlog, that when you run out of supplies or facilities, then we can be counted as your backup, right? And so, you know, I think that's really important for us to talk with our families about and say, hey, like, let's really realistically ask ourselves, if we had full sovereignty, full say, would we have shut our borders down? Would we have, you know, said, okay, right now we need to just focus on our community? I would hope so.
Heather Rosario?
So in terms of your question, in terms of creating these conversations, I think you also need to create these spaces. In Ihagen Famalawan, we always talk about creating safe spaces together and being able to speak what you think, and especially in terms of political status and decolonization. It's great to create these spaces, not only to speak your thoughts, but to also gain information. Because I think a lot of people may either know not enough about one or too much of the other, but it's always good to create these spaces to talk to one another. And also take it with a grain of salt, I think, because everything that I may say to someone else, they may not agree with, and that's okay. That's absolutely fine. But it's really about, in order to create the conversation, we have to create the space, being able to speak with one another and being okay with how we feel and what we think.
I want to echo what Heather said too about having these conversations in a very loving manner. I think depending on who you ask, it will evoke different kinds of emotions. And one of the first things I think I would like to ask these people who feel that it might be an anti-military campaign to say, you know, please keep the sailors on base. One of the first things I would ask is, why does it feel like an anti-military campaign? I mean, I come from a social work background, and perhaps it's my growing practice in counseling that I would ask people their perspective to get to have a better idea of where their thinking is leading their whatnot. I'm sorry. But another thing that I really want to echo from the article that Victoria mentioned, at the very end of it, He writes, the crisis also raises the obvious question about human security. What use would a nuclear weapon and an aircraft carrier when doctors don't have enough beds for the sick and dying? That is, to me, like, that would be one of the most pressing things for me to articulate when I'm talking with somebody who feels that it's a problematic situation. I mean, most of all, like, I am totally against war. I'm all about peace and whatnot. And I feel that really, what is the need for a nuclear aircraft carrier and a military and military preparedness when we really need to be taking care of ourselves and our community and supporting each other in such a time of crisis?
Yeah, I think it's really important that you actually pointed that out, because I think here in Guam, we're always made to feel like we're at war, that even though it is what would be considered time of peace, and as we saw in Captain Crozier's letter, he says, this is not a time of war, this is a time of peace, so there's no reason to keep these guys on the ship. Well, in the way that it was pushed in our community as a necessity, as a priority, we were told that if we don't help them, if we don't get them fully operational and back out to sea, that we would be bombed or that there would be some kind of attack. And that, you know, now, you know, one of the big things that, you know, the military was saying, speaking of transparency, was that, of course, they can't give us the actual numbers of how many people have COVID, because then it makes us vulnerable for attack, right? Or and that, you know, either China or North Korea would be able to attack. Well, Guam is also always reminded that if that were to ever happen, we would be the place that would be bombed. So it's like either our security is threatened because we have to make room and welcome more COVID into our community in the interest of national security, or our security is threatened because if the U.S. were to be attacked, it would be us that would be bombed. And so therefore, we always do really feel like we have to make decisions as if though we are at war. And that is not fair to this community, because these are not wars that we started. These are not conflicts that we're involved in. And, you know, I think that for me, like what you were saying earlier about, you know, no one asks the tip of the spear if it wants to be used, you know, and we really are not consulted at all. And that is very disempowering. And we do always live like in this state of crisis where we, you know, it's like if we don't make this decision, if we don't sacrifice what we know to be right for ourselves, then we become more vulnerable for attack. And that wasn't very fair of, you know, our leaders or the military to say to our community that we really need you for the interests of national security right now. You know, that and that's what we're so used to. We're always told that even though we feel like something isn't right, even though we feel that it isn't right for them to disturb our sacred sites, even though we feel it isn't right for them to potentially contaminate our water, even though we feel that it isn't right for them to destroy thousands of acres of our limestone forest, we have to do it for national security. And that's not acceptable anymore. And I think more and more people are saying that, you know, actually, in fact, I don't feel safe here. I feel like I'm always living in a war and I don't want that for my future. You know, the first several nights in a row when everything was supposed to be shut down and it's so quiet in my village, I can hear the bombers even louder, just flying right over us, constantly flying over us. And it's like, I thought we weren't at war. What's going on? I thought we're supposed to be shut down. Why are they, you know, why are these bombers flying night after night over my home? And it was so incredibly loud amidst the silence that it was just a reminder that, you know, for those of us living in a colony, we are always at war.
Oh, that's it's so true. It's very, very interesting, this whole situation, because we see people arguing that you know, that we should be willing to sacrifice for our fellow countrymen, for the United States and so on. And there's this feeling of patriotism in that. But one thing that on Guam we're so used to feeling like we are insufficient or less than the United States, right? That's why your relatives in California always tease because we don't have a Best Buy on Guam, or we don't have a Target on Guam, and stuff like that. But we never see the other side of that equation, which is that why is it that Guam is asked to take on more than your average person in the United States is asked to take on? So why is it, for example, that we don't hear from across the United States that states and communities and towns and Best Westerns and Hiltons and Marriotts are all over the country being flooded with sailors and with Marines and with soldiers? Why aren't we hearing that across the United States, there are people all over are bringing potential COVID infected soldiers into their community to show that they love America, to show that they are proud to be American? And so that's one of the things that's so interesting about the way that we feel our connection to the United States is it's not like a secure connection. Because if you're a secure connection, then you don't have to be patriotic. You're part of the country. You don't got to sacrifice more than anyone else because you feel like I'm an American. So it's interesting because even in this feeling that we have to do extra to prove we're American, we end up showing that we recognize that we aren't really American. We're less, we have to do more in order to prove that we're worthy of them looking at us. We're worthy of them giving us citizenship, giving us the right to vote, and so on. And so it's so interesting because how can we, one thing that I wanted to ask though, because when this Theodore Roosevelt thing came out, you had thousands of news articles appearing across the United States. And only a small handful of them ever talked to anybody who's actually on Guam. And in fact, many of the news articles talked about the Theodore Roosevelt and didn't even mention Guam at all. They focused on the situation of the sailors, and eventually they transitioned to focusing on the captain, the heroism of the captain, his bold sort of leadership and breaking the chain of command for the lives of his soldiers. And so it's fascinating that even when the U.S. has turned to Guam in a moment of crisis like this, they still won't look at the Chamorro people. They still won't look at the island. They still won't recognize and see or hear our voice. And so so one thing that I wanted to give each of you the opportunity to think about though is, if you could sort of speak to people in the United States. So if we imagine that everybody who read an article about Captain Crozier, about the Theodore Roosevelt, that they had that all of those articles were suddenly hacked and they had a paragraph featuring a voice from somebody on Guam about what they feel about this situation. If you could speak to people in the United States, what would you tell them? What would you want them to hear about what the people of Guam feel about the situation? Heather or Rosario or Victoria?
So I'll go first. as a person from Guam, you know, we're just as afraid. We have so much fear because there's so much uncertainty. And I'm sure that's exactly what you feel out in the United States. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if it's going to get better in the next month, if it's going to get worse in the next month. We truly don't know. And we're upset at the situation with the USS Roosevelt. Why? Because we're fighting our own battle here at home. We already have 100 some cases. I'm not sure the exact number today because I'm pretty sure it's probably changed from yesterday. But we're fighting our own battle here, our own war against this pandemic, and we are afraid. And we're hoping that as we follow these social distancing laws, which we hope that everyone as well is following, as well as this 14-day quarantine, that we're going to get better.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely feel the same way that like what she's saying is that we have enough, you know, that we're also trying to respond to, and we're just like anybody in the world, really trying to do the best to protect and care for our people. And that in situations like this, America doesn't think about Guam or our people. And so we must think of our people. One of the big things that I would really like Americans to reflect on is what you really consider leadership to be. You know, a lot of the attention, as Maget mentioned, shifted onto Captain Crozier and the sympathy people felt for him being fired. And you know, and it really became quickly a political issue with Democrats, you know, rallying behind him and wanting to investigate the Trump administration's actions. But really, it lost sight of the fact that not only were these sailors' lives put at risk, but now an entire community of people that had nothing to do with any of these decisions that were being made are also put at risk. That Captain Crozier clearly was very respected as a great leader, but he and the Pacific PACCOM Admiral made the decision to go to Vietnam, even though they knew that there was already COVID there. They were going on a trip to Vietnam to celebrate 25 years of diplomacy between the U.S. and Vietnam, and with the intention to further secure their relationship so that they could have a stronger you know, relationship with Vietnam against China. And they knew that there were already almost 24 cases there. And they decided that it was worth it to be able to have this diplomatic visit. Well, then, if that was the case, if they wanted to go there to show diplomacy, to strengthen their relationship, then why did they also let sailors off and go stay in hotels and get their R&R, knowing that they could be exposed to COVID? To me, that would have been the moment where Captain Crozier's leadership would have been essential. If the admiral had said, okay, guys, we want you to go to Vietnam, we're going to dock, you're going to go off, we're going to do these, you know, diplomatic meetings or ceremonies or whatever they did to celebrate their 25 years of diplomacy. If he was in those meetings, why didn't he say, you know what? I have 5,000 people on board this carrier. Even one of them getting COVID is too big of a risk for us to let any of them off this ship. No, he didn't. He didn't speak up then. People got off the ship. They came back on with COVID. And then weeks later, there's this urgency and there's this response and there's this need to dock on Guam and this need to get them off the ship. And our people are the ones that must face the consequences of those bad decisions that were made when they went to Vietnam. And I just think that it's indicative of not just the military's short-sightedness, but also the United States' inability to see that COVID was something to be concerned about. And, you know, I've heard from others who, you know, I've seen like posts online, for example, from people in the military that say that they've been trained for every single kind of emergency, that they should know how to have handled this, that they should have been more prepared, that they should have had more foresight, that when they were making their way back to Guam, they should have been working with people here in Guam to figure out how to quarantine them within their facilities. But no, it's like they showed up and were like, hey, we don't know what to do. Can you help us? And that wasn't fair to this community. And, you know, Americans who don't think about this community, who have written us out of all of these stories, need to remember that just because you don't think about us, we're still here suffering the consequences of your actions.
If I had to insert like a little paragraph, as you said, Dr. Bavakwa, into a news article, I think I would say something. Guam has, you know, it's the indigenous home of, it's the home of indigenous Chamorro people. We are loving, we're kind, and we're rare. With our political status, it just doesn't seem right to endanger this already small percentage of Chamorros to this very deadly virus. I mean, Guam, you know, we're all about helping our community and our family members and further. And sometimes, you know, typical tomorrows, we put ourselves before other, after other people. And at this point in time, I think it calls for us to be reminded of the imbalanced relationship. And we need a little bit, we need more balance, and we need more ability for Guam to protect ourselves. Because currently, I mean, the U.S. military is one of the most funded branches. I don't know. They're just the richest in the world. I mean, they can build islands. They can occupy different parts of the world with such ease. And they could very easily get test kits for 5,000 of their cruise ships. And Guam is suffering to test and keep up with everything that's happening here. And we just don't have the same amount of resources to help in that capacity. And even at that, I think it's only fair that Guam is asked the help instead of demanded the help.
For all of your points. So we do have some questions. We have some questions that people have been kind enough to provide on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And so let's see here. Okay, so this is an interesting one. If it is really not us versus them in terms of Guam and the U.S. military here, then why do they give a housing allowance that is far, far higher than what many working families and civilians on Guam can compete with and afford? So this person wants to know if it really is an us, if it really is a one Guam dynamic here, where the military and the government of Guam and the people are partners in this, then why is it that they still give this housing allowance, which creates a big imbalance in sort of the community?
Housing allowance in regard, are they referring to like the financial support of Gura? Is that the housing allowance they're referring to? I'm a little...
They're referring to the overseas housing allowance, which allows stationed military to live off base. And the money that they receive is much higher than what your average family makes, which creates problems then where renters, landlords will drive the prices up to cater to the military, and then it'll sort of push locals out and push them down. And so the person, I believe, is asking if there really is any truth to this one Guam, then why does the military sort of give this allowance to the people here, even though it hurts the local community by making it harder for a middle and lower income people to find places to live, makes their rents go up and so on?
I mean, I don't know that any of us know sort of the scale with which the U.S. military figures out its like cost of living allowance and housing allowance. But the way I read that question is, I think that the person is just making a valid point or a valid observation that the military's presence here really offsets the local community's ability to afford housing. And I think a lot of people experience that because if people in the military are given a housing allowance that will allow them to pay over $1,000 worth of rent and much more, some $2,000 in rent, then now even a basic one-bedroom home is difficult to find under $1,000, and our minimum wage doesn't reflect that. And whereas the military gets a housing allowance on top of their salary, and so it really is not fair, because you can't compete with that locally if all of the landlords then suddenly want to rent to the military and no longer want to rent to locals or drop their prices for locals. So I think it's more an observation than a question that any of us could really answer. But it is a good observation. I think another kind of keeping it on topic with the Roosevelt, another observation that members of the Hagen Famalawan had made in a chat group was that our frontliners, our medical professionals who need to be quarantined from their families because of exposure to COVID, aren't being given hotel rooms to stay in. And, you know, whereas local leaders have been trying for the last couple weeks to try to get them hotel rooms to stay in that are close to the hospitals they work at. You know, but then when the military needed hotel rooms, it took 2 days to get these sailors into the hotel rooms. And I think that is a clear indicator of priority and urgency that we should be allowing our medical professionals into the hotels, that makes more sense, but you know, that didn't happen. You know, when I was reading the Post article of family members of one of the Chamorro sailors that were on board, they said, "We don't want our son sleeping on a cot. We want him to be safe and in a hotel room." And, you know, I understand any family is going to want their child to be as safe as possible with as little exposure to becoming sick as possible. But at the same time, you know, sailors and people in the military are trained to sleep in many different kinds of conditions. They've been sleeping on a ship. Literally, it became whether or not they would sleep on a cot or the Dusit Tawny. And yet, our medical professionals, I'm sure, are having to sleep in on-call rooms or sleep in very, you know, and not in comfortable, you know, situations after 16 plus hours of working. And so I think that to me is also an inequity to point out, that's really valid, because, you know, these guys are in our best hotels right now.
Okay. Heather Rosario? Oh, wait. So let me move to the next. Or did any? Okay. So the next question. Will the coronavirus pandemic, do you think that it'll slow down the military buildup?
I think this question again relates to transparency, because the military will not inform us whether or not they're still bringing in more soldiers. They will definitely not, especially during this time after the backlash of the USS Roosevelt. I believe that if they decide to, they will definitely not inform us. And that's due to transparency. But I do believe they had already begun bringing soldiers over since late last year. I'm sure of that. But in terms of numbers, if we know if they're going to slow it down, that relates to transparency. And we don't know. But we hope so.
Yeah, I want to follow what Heather said. When I first saw that question, first thing I said was my personal opinion. I really hope it slows the military buildup. It, in my opinion and in my beliefs, it would be a blessing. For a number of reasons, in the environmental impact statement of how much damage the military buildup would do, I would hope that it slows the military buildup. There was another point that I wanted to get to that, but I'll say it later if I remember.
I did hear that construction was continuing. I remember in the early days of sort of our shelter in place orders, it was saying that construction work would continue. I remember reading that, but again, we really don't know what degree of construction is occurring and, you know, what contractors are still here and who is still working, because, yeah, there is not like this open line of communication between the military and our local community about it. And kind of related on this tip of transparency, I want to say hafidi to Kyle Kejihiro in Hawaii. He's one of our good friends who works over there for the freedom and sovereignty of Native Hawaiians. Hafide Kyle, I saw your question asking if there were COVID cases emerging from those sailors who were moved into the hotels. Again, we don't know. That hasn't been reported to the community. So as of yet, we haven't heard of any cases. I think a lot of this is, these are really important questions, but not ones that we're really equipped to answer.
So the next question is, as the coronavirus leads the world to kind of grind to a halt, this person asks, the colonial world and the colonial systems, as they grind to a halt, does this create any opportunities for us in Guam for large or small kind decolonization? So as sort of as the world around us, as so let's say like people are staying home, schools are out, people are thinking about sort of how to survive, how to get by. People are thinking about sort of more about the food that they eat and how they get the food that they eat. Are there any possibilities in this moment for sort of us to think more about small decolonization in our lives or large scale decolonization?
I think it's small and large is absolutely possible from my perspective. I think if anything, I wouldn't be surprised if it calls for a large scale push for decolonization, because as it has been reiterated all of tonight, being a territory has been the biggest impediment in protecting ourselves. So it would make sense that seeing the consequences of being a territory would push people to be like, okay, something needs to change.
Victoria or Heather?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, as was mentioned earlier, creating more spaces like this where we can reflect on what's happening and where we can more clearly see how it's connected to our status as an unincorporated territory is really important for our community. I think, you know, during times like this, we're also reminded of the need for us to be able to better take care of ourselves, that it would be very impossible for Guam to fully shut its borders because most of our food and our medical equipment and our medical supplies come from elsewhere. Whereas, you know, for thousands of years before colonization, our ancestors were able to provide all the food and healing that, you know, they needed right here. And so I think that, you know, as we are home and as we are connecting, hopefully more with the land that we live on, we're able to start to take more action towards greater self-determination, more towards greater self-reliance. But also, I think, again, what I had mentioned earlier, that the colonial policies that disable us during a time of crisis from being able to protect our community really need to change. And it is my hope that coming out of this, our community is more aware of that.
I agree with Lola and Rosario in that it's definitely possible. And this is also a very great time because we do have more time on our hands where if we want to talk about it, if our family wants to talk about it, if our friends want to talk about it, we're here and we're available for them.
All right, here's another question. Are there any efforts to unify military and civilian resources to combat the virus together? Because the person says that that sounds like what would happen if we were really in it together on this island. So, anybody?
So, I really wish that we were working together. But it's been seen through our efforts to gain tests in the very beginning of this pandemic. We were struggling, you know, I believe she asked for much more than 200 and that's all we got. And then we hear that the USS Roosevelt was infected and they got an enormous amount of tests just for them. And we were struggling. So I really wish that we had a stronger relationship in order to work together and, you know, protect our people, and most especially our Mananku. But that's truly not the case at hand.
Victoria or Rosario?
I kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but yeah, I mean, I think it was really evident when we were asking for test kits, and even as of, you know, the latest sort of press reports, we're still waiting for, I believe, 4,000 kits to come in. Which to me, I was like, hey, you had 800 test kits on board. You're saying you're going to test all 5,000 sailors. can you also bring the ones Guam needs with you? So I think that if they're able to test that many people and we're still doing 20 to 40 tests a day, then it's very clear that, you know, Guam is not necessarily being helped by the rapid ability of this, this ship to bring in test kits. Guam will obviously be experiencing other benefits from its relationship with the federal government through the stimulus and other economic measures that are going to be taken. But that's actually the U.S.'s obligation as, Guam's administering power to be able to assist during times like this. It wasn't because Guam hosted the Roosevelt that we are going to be experiencing that. That is part of this relationship, and it will help people on Guam. If Guam were to become independent, we would also be able to, seek out international aid or other sources of aid. This is all very common, right, for larger countries to help smaller countries. So, I think that to me, from what I see and what I hear from my home, I'm relying only on what comes out in the media. No, I don't think that there has been a very clear sharing of resources at all.
All right, next question. A lot of people are saying that housing the military is a way for us to repay them for protecting our freedom. Do you think that the U.S. military engagements today and in the past two decades have been about protecting Americans' freedoms and in turn Guam's freedom? So people are saying, yeah. So who wants to tackle that one?
I think I'd like to begin with the assumption of the question. I think I should just reiterate it one more time. The beginning of the question is saying that a lot of people are stating that housing the military is a way for us to repay them for protecting our freedom. Just in this assumption that we're repaying them, it's giving the assumption that we owe them, something. And if we owe them something, then that's not implying that we have a mutual relationship. That's implying that it's a symbiotic relationship where the military is giving us more than what we're giving in return. But that it's this assumption that I don't necessarily agree with. I just wanted to start off by talking about that.
This is a whole nother podcast, but really an important question, right? So again, kind of what I talked about earlier, that this idea that the U.S. military's presence in our region somehow makes us safer or protects our freedom. But when we unpack what that means, typically when people think of the freedoms that we receive from being, from being quote unquote American, those freedoms are not actually rights that are extended to people living in territories, the most blatant one being the right to vote for all your leaders, right? The other thing is sort of safety, right? That in fact, the U.S.'s presence in Guam since, World War II and even prior to World War II, Guam was attacked on the same day as Pearl Harbor, has actually made the people of Guam less safe. The people that would attack Guam would not be attacking the people of Guam or the indigenous Chamorro people of Guam who have always been here. No, they are attacking the United States, and that Guam is actually a buffer, that the fact that Guam is here in this region means that a country could attack Guam as a poke at the U.S. and would likely attack Guam before attacking the continental U.S., again, making us more unsafe. No, I don't feel like I owe the U.S. anything at all right now, because I feel that we actually give up a lot. We give up full representation in our governance. We've given up our land. We've given up our water, right? We literally pay the Navy for water that is ours. We've given up a lot. And, you know, people, some of the stuff that came out were like, oh, this is our chance to shine, right? Someone wrote that this is Guam's chance to shine, or this is Guam's chance to repay the U.S. for liberating us during World War II. All of those things really point to a lack of more deeply evaluating Guam's history, that the United States didn't return to Guam to save the people or bring us freedom. They returned to Guam to basically win the war against Japan and bombed most of the island in the process, and then used 75% of the island in that war effort, and only slowly gave lands back. And to this day, a whole third of the island has never been given back to those original landowners. Guam continues to pay by, you know, our people serving in this very military. And so I think that it's really unfair to say that we owe the military anything when in fact the relationship is incredibly imbalanced the other way around. It was so disappointing that our values were used against us for questioning the sailors being allowed into the hotels, that this was a form that we needed to welcome them into the community as a form of Inafet Maulik. And, you know, Inafet Maulik, what it means is that we all work together for the good of all. Was this decision really for the good of all, or was it for the good of the mission of that carrier and those sailors? Because if it was for the good of all, then it would have made sense to contain them in a place where they wouldn't be exposing the already vulnerable community to COVID. And also, Inafet Maulik isn't like, oh, I'm going to help you just because you helped me. And that's what it turned into. Like the day after the governor announced that, yes, they were going to stay in the hotels, she puts out, you know, a press release that, you know, the military is going to help us get all of these things. We've made requests for test kits and ventilators and all these things from the military. And it's like, why is it like that? Why is it that we can only ask for the things we need when we've given them something? It should be always a natural relationship in which there's reciprocity, but that's not the case here. And I really feel that, you know, if we are believing that somehow we owe the military anything, that there needs to be a closer examination of our history.
Sidzus Masi, Mutoro Samza, we are just about at the end of our time. And so we have more questions. But I wanted to give each of you the chance to sort of give some final thoughts on sort of the discussion that we've had so far. And you can comment on anything sort of that's come up or anything that we didn't address. But we had a nice sized audience watching us today. And so Heather, we'll start with you, then Rosario, and then Victoria. So go ahead and sort of, what are your final thoughts about this discussion?
My final thoughts on this discussion is that, looking at how I've been feeling and how my family's been feeling and how we've been dealing with this situation, I'm still afraid to this day. I'm young, and they've said that, you know, people in my age range have a very high likelihood of being okay, but there's so much uncertainty and there's so much to be afraid of. And I'm praying for my people, for my Manumku, and I still don't feel like they should be let into our community at this point. And so I'm hoping for the best for our community, and I'm hoping that we're going to be fine.
I wanted to carry into my answer to one of the questions, which was, do I think the U.S. military engagement today and in the past hasn't really been about protecting America's freedom and Guam's freedom? No, I absolutely do not think so. Like I've said earlier in the podcast, we're just the tip of the spear. And I mean, maybe not just, let me rephrase that. Guam, I think, and I believe strongly, is incredibly powerful, and the US military knows it. So we're an asset. We're an asset to ourselves. We're an asset to each other. We're an asset to the world, and we're an asset to the military. And as a weapon of war and protection of America's freedom, I mean, I'm sure there were times where, you know, the military felt like they were really trying and doing their best to ensure human rights and protection. But at this point in time and Guam's involvement in the military, I don't see that. I don't see the pattern. Sure, they gave chocolate and helped out during the war. But I think beyond that, even into current day, it's not about protecting freedom and it's about protecting their assets. And I think the last thing that I'd like to say is I hope that there comes a realization for everybody, for it to be even deeper or first coming to the realization that Guam is incredibly powerful and we are incredibly important. We are incredibly resources, regardless of how small we are and regardless of the Chamorro is only being 40% of the population, roughly. But I think I'd just like to end on that.
I would just first like to thank the other participants in this interview. Thank you all for your voices, for the women who were brave and stood up and wrote the letter and worked hard on staying responsive and reminding our community of what matters. I want to thank them. I really want to thank everybody who really is putting their life at risk and helping those who are sick get better. And I want to ask that we continue to be brave, that it is not being divisive to ask questions, that it is okay to ask for more of our leaders and to encourage them to be bold at a time where it matters most. And I do actually still want to appeal to our MAGA Haga that she remember her own personal power as the leader of this island and as a strong Chamorro woman, as somebody with a master's in public health and a career in nursing, that at the end of the day, the people she should be thinking of always are the people of Guam. And I know that she is, and I hope that she makes, you know, better decisions for us, and that she feels the support and the encouragement of other women, even if in being critical, she may not agree, to know that there are other women in this island who are here, who are willing to, you know, support bold decisions and to support that power. Because, you know, it's interesting, I heard, and it really hurt me to hear this, but I'd heard some people on the radio and I'd seen some comments online about, oh, yay, the future is Famalawan, the future is female, and look at what's happening now, and kind of critiquing the governor's leadership as indicative of women leadership. And that was really painful because, you know, that's not what this is about here. I think any leader in her position would be challenged and would be critiqued. This isn't about whether or not we need a man or a woman right now. We need everybody working together and taking each other seriously and not dismissing voices like the voices that have spoken today or that spoke in that letter, but rather really listening and trying to say, where are they coming from and what are they asking me to do and how can I be better for my people and how can I be brave? And that's what I would ask of our governor, but also of all of us. Let's be brave. Let's be compassionate. And let's truly support each other as we try to figure this mess out. Because if there's anything Guam is known for, it's our ability to work as a family in the best interests of our people.
Nice. Jesus masi gefpogu na ikompensasyon tapog. I appreciate all of you for coming and for speaking. And thank you to everyone who submitted questions and was watching. And so just a reminder, Fanatsu is independent indigenous media. It's the official podcast for independent Guahan, and it's made possible through the support of viewers like all of you. And so ang ganzamu esti pagpabot, supporteham gi Patreon, honogwaptu ang gantagutin ng omupod Patreon, honogwaptu pada patreon.com. And if you are able, please support a Fanatsu. Lo, Megan is a Jus Masim and Toto Samsutalo. And so thank you all again. And we will see you all next time. Adios. Estaki.